Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Dave Moore
on Today FM
podcast.
Well, I got Colly Ennis with me, who you'll know from the show if you've listened over the years, because anytime we need to talk about anything with four legs or slithery ribs or any kind of tail or potentially poisonous bites, Colly is the man we talk to. Colly, you're the co-host of Critter Shed. You also hold a master's from Trinity in zoology, but we'll get to that because you don't have a traditional path to all of this thing that's going on in your life right now. Would that be fair?
Very true, yeah.
So when did you first get interested in exotic animals, I guess we'll call them? Because you're interested in also not exotic animals, we should say. It's not just spiders and snakes and lizards. It's also...
native stuff, yeah.
Yeah, stuff that's in Ireland that you love. But when did you first start getting interested in that side of things?
Around 8 years old, I went into Georgia Street Arcade to the pet shop.
I remember it well,
just off Georgia Street. And I saw a little lizard-type creature called a fired-bellied newt. And... It all led from that. I had to have it, and then,
At that age, did you have any previous knowledge, or was this new to you and to your family at that point? Like, your mom and dad weren't, like, experts in lizard fire-bellied newts, no?
My mom and dad are green-fingered and would have loved nature.
Gotcha.
And a great garden, and that's been passed on to me as well, but the exotic pets, no, absolutely not.
That was
so
new.
Of course, back then we didn't have the internet, so it was all about going out to libraries, picking up books.
Reading books, yeah.
Learning. And I'm still a big advocate for books. I know apps are brilliant and identifying apps on your phone are great for plants and insects, but a field guide is something you hold in your hand. It's really tangible, and it's something that, you know, I think you pick up things better from them. You remember.
Plus, you can go back over it.
Exactly.
Like, you know, it's sitting there looking at you on your shelf and go, oh, I'll flick through that again. Yeah.
Little notes in the corner.
Yes, exactly. I remember that. Okay, so that starts you off. And then how quickly does your collection of animals expand? Or are we slowly getting into this?
Slowly. Try to make sure that everything has appropriate space and habitat. That's really important. You don't want to get into buying lots of stuff and not having anywhere for them to live correctly.
Yeah.
So slowly over the years. And then, of course, when you're renting properties, it's difficult to keep animals in some areas. When I got my own place, then I built my own fully equipped
shed.
It's up to zoo quality in the habitats.
And then talk to us then about how you became involved in the Department of Zoology in Trinity, because that is, as I said, that's the non kind of traditional scenario. So you were a Sparks, right? You were an electrician.
Sparks, yeah. And then when the crash happened, of course, everybody was moving to Australia, and you're kind of thinking, do I want to take that route or do I want to stay in Dublin? And I was coaching martial arts in Trinity College, saw an ad for a security officer in the college and applied for a 6-month period.
Yeah.
And I've been there 25 years. So, yeah, it's just one of those things. It was just a bit of serendipity that it just happened. Through that, then, of course, because of my interest in animals and working in conservation work outside of my regular job
I
got chatting to the zoology department, and they're all a great bunch in there and very, very knowledgeable, very welcoming. Exchange of ideas happened. And then I started working with them on various projects, and now...
But there aren't many security officers in Trinity who will get involved in the education departments of the college. You might go and check and make sure everything's locked up or whatever. But the fact that, like, they must have realised that you were bringing, maybe not the book knowledge in the traditional sense, but you're bringing the experience, the field experience, the fact that you've had these animals at home. So you're possibly bringing things that they don't have necessarily.
Yeah, it's a two-way relationship there. And, you know, I do have a lot of hands-on experience doing stuff. I work with the Herpetological Society of Ireland, and they're a great bunch of herpers, a great bunch of reptile and amphibian. Great bunch of reptile and amphibian experts. So, you know, and that's quite specialised. And, you know, traditional routes in zoology, people kind of go for the furry stuff.
Of course, yeah.
And I think when you show them the slimy and the creepy crawly stuff, and I have a big interest in spiders, obviously, are one of my big passions as well, and arachnids. So you kind of open students' eyes up to different avenues and more specialised avenues as well. So,
but this grew to the point where you were given an honorary master's in Trinity. Is that right?
Yeah, Trinity gave
us... Dude, that's unreal.
Yeah, it was great. It was a great day out and I got to wear a silly hat and
a
cap.
A silly hat and
running around like
yeah.
Batman. It was fantastic.
That's brilliant. Alan's been on. He says, Collie has been a great help to us here at the ISPCA over the years. A sound man with a wealth of knowledge. That's absolutely what he is.
Thank you, Alan.
We'll get to some of the questions that have come in. We'll do that in a few minutes' time. But just sticking with your own story. So... you have your own, as you said, up to zoo quality critter shed at home with, I don't know how many creatures you have in there. I keep meaning to come down and actually see it. You've offered me the invitation many times and I will at some point. But I mean, how many, what kind of numbers of beings are you dealing with in there?
It depends. Like, so it's kind of secular on an annual basis. So you'll have a breeding season for spiders and each one of those spiders can have a couple of hundred spiderlings. And
right.
So the numbers fluctuate and if I decide to breed them, then I'll have a lot. But I have around about 40 to 50 tarantulas at any given time, and then I've 13 odd snakes.
I thought you were going to say 40 to 50 altogether of all the animals, but no, that's just tarantulas.
Yeah, and then a lot of scorpions, a lot of spiders. The snakes and the reptiles I take in are all rescues.
Rescues, okay,
yeah,
right.
You know, people take them on board sometimes and situations change.
Yeah.
So I try and take in them and look after them as best as possible as well.
And then talk to me about things like, so if you breed spiders, right, and you, as you said, there could be hundreds of babies, you can't presumably let those hundreds of babies develop into hundreds of adults.
Believe me, I tried.
You've tried.
I tried. I'd be divorced, though. Welcome to the tarantula town.
Yeah,
tale,
you know, yeah, yeah. But like, can you then, you know, pass them on to other people or sell them or do whatever? Like, can you get rid of that many? You can't presume. You don't just let them out into the garden and see what happens with the tarantulas.
Exactly. You can't let them out. They wouldn't live here anyway.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's a mortality rate with all these things, animals well. So some of them won't make it. The ones that do get to the teenage stage, for want of a better word, can go to, you know, responsible pet shops.
Gotcha.
That will sell them to people who know what they're doing.
Who know what they're doing,
And there's a very nice community of tarantula keepers in Ireland, all of us weirdos, and we'll kind of exchange spiders as well.
Yeah, so, okay, fair enough. You mentioned getting divorced there. What do the family think of all this? Is it now a kind of tacit acceptance of... dad or the hubby is just a crazy animal, or there's kind of any reluctance towards these creatures?
It was a package deal, so like they know no different. They go to people's houses with dads who are into, you know, football and think they're crazy, you know.
Well, if you haven't got 14 tarantulas in one room,
why is there no snakes in this house? You know, it's just a package deal, so they've grown up with it, and they just accept it, and very grateful for them for allowing me to do it.
But listen, I want to get to some of the questions that have come in, Collie, because every time you come in, every time you're on the show, whatever, we're talking about something, and then usually by the time you've gone, there's a rake of questions coming in about something else. So Mary and Claire is one for you. So she's a teacher and says, a thing shot across the classroom floor so fast I thought it might be a coin or a ring rolling. We discovered, though, it was an insect about the size of a 10-cent piece, like a spider, but not. Its body looked like a bit like a wasp, but with no colour. Any ideas what that might be?
So it could be, if it's on the ground and it hasn't got wings, it's probably a queen ant.
Oh, a queen ant. All right. Yeah, so it might be moving from a previous colony to try and set up a new one.
Exactly.
Or it could be a new queen.
So the new queens will fly off on the wing.
Yeah.
They'll mate with the males and then they'll land and they'll literally chew their wings off. They'll drop their wings and then go off looking for somewhere to set up a new colony, a new nest.
So many of us, if we're given the choice of a superpower, would pick flight. Why would the queen ant decide, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take this amazing USP that I have and chew my own wings off. Well, is there a logic there?
It's basically the flight is only really to get them away from the previous colony and to really establish a place. And it's how they spread. After that, all she is basically all about is just laying eggs. And making more ants. And then, in turn, more queens will leave from that colony and so on and so forth.
And isn't there that stat that the... combined gross weight of all the ants in the world is more than all the humans in the world.
There you go.
Yeah, something like that.
Crazy.
Yeah. Now, listen, you're very into like biodiversity. You're very into rewilding and stuff you can do practically. You don't have to go and buy 75 acres of farmland and start replanting trees and stuff. But in your own garden, you're always talking about how we can help. And I realise you're talking to a man who's got plastic grass, but park that for a second, Connie. Park your prejudice for a second. But you are always talking about how, you know, planting, you know, wild flowers and putting a pond in can really, really help the creatures that are native to Ireland. So if someone has a small enough garden, but they have maybe a corner of it they can do something in, what would you recommend? What's the number one thing you'd say to do?
Yeah, I mean, like, so when we go out in the morning to move our bins, you're always going to find Mr. Slug, Mr. Beetle, somebody in there. And that's essentially what they're looking for. So what I always say to people is just corner off a section of your garden if you want, and leave a bit of mess for nature.
Leave a bit of mess, right.
Pile of leaves, pile of rocks, all crushed on top of each other. A bit of standing water. Now, a pond can be as fancy or as simple as you want it to be. And then some native wildflowers or a native tree like a willow. A simple 2 meters squared in your garden will provide habitat to all sorts of creatures. And then, like that same kind of theory, you can expand that if you have a bigger garden.
If you have a bigger garden, of course.
Land. So, I mean, it's about creating a mosaic of habitats.
Now, when you said standing water, right? So I know how passionate you are about ponds and that kind of thing. I immediately think of the fact that right now in my house in Portmarnock, myself and my family are plagued by tiger mosquitoes. Like, literally plagued. We're bitten to bits and it has to be from standing water somewhere. Yes. And we don't know where that is because it must be one of the neighbours because it isn't our garden. We've checked every single gutter and gone, where could these possibly be coming from? But they're vicious and they're just, I mean, I know they're just mums getting themselves some food or whatever, but they are, they're everywhere. So what are the kind of potential, I suppose, things to look out for if you're putting a bit of standing water or a pond in? I mean, like, are mosquitoes something you're just going to have to live with?
They'll arrive.
Yeah.
And then their predators will arrive.
Right.
And munch them. So if you have standing water with a good ecosystem, with a good amount of predators arriving, you won't even notice the mosquitoes.
Right, okay.
What I recommend for you to do is to maybe invest in a bat box and put it on the side of the house.
Oh, that's a shout.
Mm-hmm. So the bats will munch mosquitoes for breakfast, dinner and tea.
Because my wife has
supper, really, because it's at night.
It's at night time, yeah. But she has been Googling every possible solution. And I just kept saying to her, it's like, it has to be a predator. Like, you're not going to catch the mosquitoes, you know. And even if you did manage to catch one or two or 10, there's another 50,000 of them just waiting around the corner. Okay, well, think about a bat box. That's a good shout. Rachel says, I know Collie has ponds. Our pond is infested with duckweed this year. We had loads of frogs, but will the duckweed kill off the tadpoles? Now, before you answer that, tell me what duckweed is.
Duckweed is a little green kind of a plant that floats on the surface of ponds and it can get out of control and really kind of smother the pond.
Okay.
So the recommendation is that I would give you is to get a plank of wood and just run it across the top of the pond. A big long plank of wood, a big, like, you know, the flap boards that you use, like decking board almost. And just run it across the top of the pond and kind of hoosh the duckweed out of the way and just allow 50% of light to get in and the tadpoles will be fine. They'll probably be fine anyway, but they do need a little bit of sunlight to help them develop quickly. So just that plank of wood will skim across the top. It's a lot safer than using a net because if you're using a net, you're going to scoop out tadpoles
as well. Of course, yeah, that makes perfect sense. A lot of people wondering about, they've had tadpoles show up last year, this year things have gone wrong or something like that. Like, this is nature. You need to not get too involved, right?
Sometimes you will have a bad year in a certain area
and
sometimes you'll have a bumper year. That's why frogs lay so many eggs because things can happen. People in ponds say, well, all my tadpoles have disappeared. They might be just down the bottom feeding because we have had a bit of a cold snap the last couple of nights. My pond, I know there's thousands in there, but you wouldn't see one of them.
Yeah.
So they're down in the mud, they're feeding away and waiting for it to get warmer and then they'll come back up later in the summer.
And every time you're in, you're on, and you're talking about these creatures. We get questions about the false widow spider.
Oh, yeah.
So there's Susie and Wexford have been in touch to say, I'm sure I've heard Collie talk about false widows before. His advice is to leave them be. But my concern and question is, surely as they are not native and they're invasive, is this wise? I was happy with the advice until I'm sure my bulldog got a bite off one, possibly from rolling in the grass. He had a huge wound afterwards. And afterwards, I saw one munching on an emerald butterfly. And butterflies are suffering numbers-wise, I've heard. So what do you think? I feel like I should do something about it, says Susie in Wexford.
Yeah, they are invasive. They are kind of creeping in and starting to come a little bit further out away from people's houses
Okay.
You're starting to notice them. If you can, or if you're worried about them, the best thing to do is dispose of them humanely by catching them in a cup. It's not that easy, though. Hoover might work as well. Go in like Ghostbusters and try and hoover them out of the hole. The problem with removing them is that a false widow spider will replace the one you removed.
Right.
We've been noticing that. And also, misidentification is very common.
Okay, so a lot of people think it's a false widow, but
exactly.
It isn't.
Yeah.
Exactly, right.
You know, and there are a lot of things that in Ireland that will give pets and people a nip as well. And false widows do kind of get thrown under the bus sometimes.
They do.
For everything else.
Yeah, it's the false widow's fault, where it may not be at all. So in that situation then, would you just recommend that you just kind of, like, just, you know, not leave it be, but like if you can, just leave it be?
There's certain areas I leave them be, like in sheds, in outhouse, out around the front of the house. I generally leave them be.
Mm. Okay, right. Well, look, Collie, we could be here all day answering all these questions. There are so many coming in, as per usual. Thank you so much. But more importantly, let's get to the quick fire round of questions that I have for you, right? Which I ask all my guests. And the first one is, what are you currently obsessed with?
God, this is embarrassing. Bigfoot.
Bigfoot?
Yeah.
The mythical creature.
I love cryptids. I love the fascination behind it. I love the culture behind it. And I just think it's brilliant. And, you know, I always joke to my kids I'm going to catch Bigfoot someday. But,
So you love the cryptid culture and all. Do you think that there is potentially a creature that is undiscovered?
Okay, so the scientific part of my brain says absolutely not.
Right.
But there's always a chance. I don't know.
Life has a strange way of figuring things out. Okay, that's fair. Who's the most famous person in that phone of yours?
John Kavanagh and Pete Builder.
Two very famous lads, in fairness. Yeah, we'll take both of them. Think back to when you were in school. You were in Crumlin, wasn't it? What school were you in when you were about, say, second class, 8 years old?
Drimnacastle.
Did you bring a lunchbox to school?
I would have. Well, tinfoil.
Tinfoil? Yes, almost a lunchbox. So what would have been inside the tinfoil?
Jam sandwiches, and I still love them to this day.
Do you know what? Somebody put a picture of a jam sandwich up the other day, and everyone was like, I haven't seen one of these in years. And I was like, why? I eat jam sandwiches all the time. They're gorgeous.
They're amazing. They're absolutely amazing.
Good shout. And the final question, Collie, I ask all my guests is, because I don't, do you wash your legs in the shower?
After a night walking around in ponds and covered in leeches and tadpoles, I definitely, definitely wash my legs in the shower.
That is absolutely fair. Even I think I would do that. Collie Ennis, I knew this would be fascinating, and I knew we could probably talk and do three or four of these in a row and nobody would mind. But thank you so much for coming in. You are the co-host of the Critter Shed podcast. People can listen to you talking about all of these things. If you can't get enough squeeze into a half an hour radio, you can do it for hours and hours on the Critter Shed podcast. And you've an event coming up that you're going to as well, don't you?
Yes. So this weekend in Ballynockin, there's a little music and culture festival on. Everybody's welcome. It's going to be amazing. It's Féile an Cnocán.
Listen, you're fluent in Irish there. That's Mahon Buchan. Féile an Cnocán.
Katie, the organiser, spelled it phonetically for
well
me.
Well done.
So, yeah, there you go.
Okay, so Ballynockin in County Wicklow.
Yeah, this Saturday and Sunday. Yeah, it's going to be brilliant.
Well, look, Collie will be there chatting away about all these kind of things if you want to go along. Enjoy it. Collie, thanks so much for coming in.
You're very welcome, man.
Cheers.
Dave Moore on Today FM podcast.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.